Now, our topic this morning is how to weather conflict with your adolescent. I thought I might write a book for parents of preteens called Preparing for Conflict. That oftentimes is a word that we can use synonymously with adolescents. And if you recall, we're talking right now about how to build this home environment that is high in unconditional involvement and high in uncompromising responsiveness. And we've been working on skills that it takes to build a home environment that provides both in a balanced kind of way. And we saw what happens when you take involvement and you leave responsiveness out. You end up with a low-high home environment, which tends to generate or breed controlling, manipulative kids. And if you just are just high on responsiveness, high expectations, a lot of control, but low on relationship and involvement, you end up with a high-low home environment that tends to produce kids that externally for a while look good. They're kind of compliant, but they become compulsive. The older they get, the more compulsive and neurotic and full of pressure and anxiety they tend to become as adults, and not real highly effective adults for the cause of Christ. So we want to see how to build this kind of high home environment, and we're talking about the skills it takes to provide high involvement first. And we're using a little formula for how you provide unconditional involvement in your kids. And the formula involves two elements. And the first element we worked on last week, and that is understanding. You have to understand somebody before you can be highly involved with them. Understanding. And last week we worked on the skills, talked about the five skills that were required to really understand your adolescent, how to make sense of his behavior. Now we want to talk about the second element, and that is relationship. Relationship. And that's really the key, by the way, in weathering conflict, is the nature of the relationship that you have with your adolescent. Do you see, providing a relationship for someone that you don't really know very deeply is not unconditional. There's always the question in their mind, if mom and dad really knew what was going on inside of me, I wonder if they'd still love me. That's why I've got to hide most of what I feel and what I think from my parents. So just relationship alone, just being a buddy, just being a friend alone is not enough to produce a high involvement type of home environment, but it takes understanding or knowledge, then relationship, and then the child has a much more the approximation of what God provides. God knows us deeply, right? He knows all the garbage that goes on in our lives and all the selfish tendencies we have, and the ugly parts of us he sees very clearly. Why in the world would he then want to have a relationship with us? See, it's an unconditional type of involvement, only possible, of course, through Jesus Christ. So it's knowledge or understanding plus relationship. And there's nothing like conflict to reveal to us what the nature of our relationship is like with our kids. Nothing like conflict for that. Now, conflict tends then to expose the nature of our relationship. And you'll notice in your chart there, we have a line like this, where on one end of the scale, we have relational dependence, and on the other end of the scale, we have relational neglect. And believe it or not, on this end of the scale, it is possible for a parent to value the relationship with their teen too much. And we know it's very possible for a parent to value their relationship with their teen too little. Now, look with me in a passage. Let's look at a few passages of scriptures we're beginning here in talking about the kind of relationship that allows us to weather conflict in a healthy kind of way. And I'll define that a little bit more as we go on. But let's just look at a few passages to let this guide our thinking. Let me first call your attention to 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7. Now, all of chapter 3 of 1 Peter is an application of a principle laid down in chapter 2. And Peter develops a principle from Christ's life. Actually, the principle is stated in shorthand form in verse 21 of chapter 2. It says this, "To this you were called, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps." That's the principle. The principle is you've been called to suffer in personal relationships. You have been called to suffer in personal relationships. Now the application of that. 3:1, wives, you've been called to suffer in relationships with your husbands. You wives might say, well, that's nothing new. I knew that. And wives, as you experience pain in relationships, you're to respond to your husbands like Christ responded to those who inflicted pain upon him. That's what Peter means when he says, wives, in the same way, you be submissive. You see, now we jump ahead to verse 7. Here's the second application. Husbands, in the same way, you be considerate. In the same ways as what? In the same way as Christ. The principles in chapter 2. You see? And what he's applying it. Now, he ran out of room in this particular chapter. He didn't ever get to the point, in the same way, parents. So we're just going to pick up on his application to husbands and see that it's the same application he'd make to parents. He says here in verse 7, husbands, in the same way, you live with your wives in an understanding way. Now, that's what we worked on last week. Is how do you live with someone in an understanding way? And it takes some skills that don't come natural. In fact, there are skills that are very, very difficult to use if you're controlled by fear rather than by love, rather than by a commitment to the truth. And that's what we find is one of the greatest obstacles to discipling parents, is that many, many parents are just controlled by fear, and they always have been. And they've never been taught the liberating aspects of the gospel, where they can really live in personal relationships being controlled by something other than fear. We naturally tend to be controlled by fear in personal relationships because all personal relationships carry with them a great risk of pain. That's why Christ says we've been called to suffer in personal relationships. Personal relationships are painful. And as we approach them then, unless we have had our hearts and our minds conditioned by something other than what comes natural, then as we approach personal relationships, we tend to negotiate them out of fear. We tend to respond and let fear control us. And what Peter's saying here is, don't let fear control you. Look what he just said in verse 6. He says, remember Sarah, chapter 3, verse 6, who obeyed that jerk Abraham and called him her master. Now, he was a jerk. Twice he exposed her to the possibility of being raped by monarchs. Once, maybe she even was, and she still submitted to this guy. She still stayed responsive. I wish we had time to go into that and talking more about what all that involves. But we'll move on. It says, you are her daughters if you do what is right and do not, what? Give way to fear. What tends to control us as we approach our kids, as we approach our spouses? Fear. And as we allow fear to control us, the techniques or the skills of parenting will elude us. They just won't be part of our natural arsenal, our natural way of responding to our kids. We'll choke, and we won't respond to them with skills. These skills are not natural then, and they're a little difficult to develop. And in a course like this, we really are not going to leave you at the end of the 12 weeks with all these skills developed. In fact, if anything, we hope to leave you a little bit, just a little bit, in despair. And the despair we hope to leave you in is this. I think it really is possible to be a good parent, but boy, it's going to take some discipline. It's going to take some more maturity in my life. I need more help. And that's why we're not taking it into the 12 weeks and dumping you and say, good luck, go out and figure out how to apply this stuff. Along with the Parents of Teens Commission, we're working and developing a whole battery of experiences, small groups, other classes, growth groups for parents of teens, support groups, individual counseling if you want that. We want to provide a whole battery of services because this is hard work, being good parents. This takes a high level of maturity. I'm finding that most parents themselves have never been discipled, and therefore it's very hard for them to disciple their own kids. So these are skills that take a little work to learn and to apply. But let's not let that discourage us, because there's a lot of skills that you use in homemaking, that you use in your business profession, that you use in your financial matters. a lot of skills that you've picked up along the way, they didn't come natural to you as a kid. And see, parenting is one of those kinds of things. It requires a sophisticated battery of skills, but they're skills that are very possible to pick up and apply, but not if you're controlled by fear. And that's at the core of what we're trying to get to with parents, is learning the fact that Christ really can liberate us from the kind of fear that makes us balk at loving. Now, chapter 3, verse 7 says, "Husbands, you live with your wives in an understanding way, and here's the second part, treat them with respect as the weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life." And we want to focus on the second part of that. How you kind of treat them as equal partners, as equal in the relationship with you, especially your kids. I believe Peter would say the same thing, that we are to respond to our kids as heirs with us of the gracious gift of life. They really are. And so we treat them with respect. That means in conflict, there's a certain kind of way that we handle relationship when we don't withdraw from them. Now, as we look at these two extremes, I want you to think about the middle one first. And the middle one is here, where relationship with our teen is a priority, but it is not a necessity. Now, that is an important distinction. Relationship with our teens is a priority, but it's not a necessity. I do not need for my teen to really return relationship with me or enter relationship with me to be able to be an effective parent. Now, I do need to make relationship a priority to be an effective parent. Now, at this end of the scale, relational neglect, we're saying at this point that relationship is looked upon as not a necessity at all, or not even a priority. This is not even seen as a priority at this end. The parent at this end kind of adopts this attitude that it's not important for me to be deeply involved with my kids or have a very good relationship with them. It's just not important. It's not a high priority. It's not important for their welfare. They can make it through life without a very close relationship with their dad. I did. I came from the kind of family that we were never close, and we never were kind of huggy, and we never sat and had long chats, but I turned out okay. So it's not just not important. It'd be nice, sure, but we're not that kind of people. And so at this end of the scale, there's an error in making relationship not even a priority. At this end of the scale, though, relationship becomes a necessity. It becomes a necessity. Now it's not just a priority, but it's a priority above all other priorities. There's nothing worth breaking relationship with my kids. And if I'm called upon to exercise authority in a way that might get my kid to break our relationship, to not love me, to move away, to kind of be angry, maybe even run away, then I won't exercise that authority as a parent, because relationship is more important. And see, a lot of kids get control of their homes this way. They blackmail their parents because they sense that relationship is a necessity for their parents. And as long as relationship is a necessity, then they can threaten to cut you off. And if you need it, you just feel like, well, I've got to have it. And a lot of mothers do this with their daughters. They become best friends. It's a necessity now because I get support from my daughter to face life. And if I didn't have a relationship with my daughter, my husband's distant. He's never around. He's always gone. Maybe there's been a divorce. Maybe he's just not around home. And so the kids have become her source of emotional tank filling. So relationship with the kids is a necessity. And to think about saying no to the kids and then being maybe ignored or pouted or rejected for the next several days and not having that support from the kids is unthinkable, so it's a necessity, and therefore it comes before everything else. Now, turn with me. Let's look at another passage. Let's look at Matthew chapter 10, verse 37. Matthew chapter 10, verse 37. Say, well, what could be more of a priority than relationship with my kids? come on, Kevin, we've been talking all along about the fact that we got to be involved with our kids deeply. We don't want to distance our kids. What could be more important than relationship with our kids? Chapter 10, verse 30 says, verse 37, anyone who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Jesus is speaking. Anyone who loves his son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And anyone who does not take up his cross and who is, by the way, willing to face rejection in relationships and follow me is not worthy of me. See, that's the same principle that Peter was just saying. Christ suffered in relationships and he's called us to suffer. That's what it means to take up our cross. Very often it means to endure pain in personal relationships for the cause of Christ. In order to enhance someone else's spiritual growth or to deepen our own relationships with Christ, very often we need to carry our cross in relationships. But the one who is not willing to endure, possibly people cutting them off, is not worthy of me. Verse 39, whoever finds his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Now what he's saying is this, if you live with self-protective goals, if your goal is to get for yourself to fill your own emotional tank, you will lose your life. You'll end up empty and bankrupt. But if you live your life with self-abandonment, the point of my relationship with my kids is not what I can get from them. I don't need anything from them. I'm not in this to get any emotional nourishment. I'm willing to lose my life for my kids. Then that person will find life. They will find all the resources for life they need. Everything will be provided by Christ that they ultimately need for life and for eternity. But he who tries to find his own resources for life ends up losing them and he's empty. His kids are the ones who most likely, as adults, walk away. He'll be the one that'll be lonely. The person that sacrificed personal integrity for the sake of keeping relationships together is the person in the end will be totally abandoned. But it's the person who took a stand for personal integrity for the sake of his own spiritual growth and other spiritual growth in their relationship with God. It's that person who in the end will not be totally abandoned, but will have life and the relationships that they need for life. You see, that's the principle. So relationship with my kids is a priority, but it's not a necessity. Only one thing is a necessity, and that is relationship with God. That's necessity. And whenever my kid's relationship with God comes up against my relationship with them, and one or the other has to be sacrificed, then I'm willing to sacrifice my relationship with them in order to move them toward God. And that means that if I feel like at some point I need to confront my kids because I feel like they're moving away from Christ, they're living by foolish strategies, they're living independent of Him, if at any point I need to get involved and intervene, knowing the kid's going to get mad, knowing the kid might withdraw a relationship from me, I'll do it. Because in my mind, the one necessity is relationship with Christ for me and for my kid. And sometimes I have to sacrifice relationship with my kid for a higher priority, and that is relationship with Christ, both personally and for my kids. See, sometimes I've even called upon that personally to make a choice. Somebody wants me to do something which causes me to violate personal integrity and a break in my relationship with Christ. I must say no, knowing that they might leave me. They might fire me. They might think I'm whatever and withdraw from me. But for the sake of spiritual growth, for the sake of my relationship with God, which is a necessity, I'm willing to sacrifice relationship with others, which is a priority, but it's not the highest priority. Are you following me? Following me with that? Do you see, if we begin to put relationships with people above our relationship with Christ, we turn up over here being relationally dependent, and we will not handle conflict correctly. Conflict will not be handled in a healthy kind of way if we're relationally dependent people. In the face of conflict, we will not have the strength to exercise the skills to be an effective parent. Or if you're over here and you've been neglecting your personal relationships, not for the cause of Christ, but because you've been making other things, getting your own tank filled, more important, you see, then when you're in the face of conflict, you won't have really the the relationship or the personal influence in the person's life to be able to react to conflict in any way that's helpful or constructive. So to be come over here and say, my relationship with my kids is not a top priority, puts you out of you're not eligible now to really handle conflict in a way that it results in the spiritual health of your family. Or to go over here and make yourself too dependent on your family, put yourself ineligible to use these skills too. Now here's what normally happens though. Conflict is good in pointing out that we're not where we should be in our relationship. Conflict, almost always when there's conflict in our family, which is about once a day, it serves to expose to me that in one way or another, I have not been making the relationships with my kids, putting them in the proper balance. And that's why conflict can be very, very healthy. Because it's a monitor or a thermometer for me. It lets me know where my relationship is with my kids and whether it's at a healthy point. Now, here we have a knockdown, drag-out argument at our house. Once we did. And I find out from the situation with my daughter that I really have not really worked at understanding her. And so my response to conflict and to a point of crisis in the home was very inappropriate. Now, after the conflict's over, I discovered that I really blew it. My tendency is, instead of going back and working on the relationship, my tendency is to say, conflict is bad, therefore I'm going to avoid conflict. Do you see? Conflict serves to show us where our relationships are deficient, and oftentimes when we see they're deficient, we come to the conclusion, that means I ought to avoid conflict. And see, that's not the point. That's not really a choice. You can try to avoid conflict, but it'll hurt your family. See, conflict is good and should be welcomed. Oh, great, we're going to have a family fight now. Not that way. But see, conflict is something that is not going to destroy my family. What is going to destroy my family is relational immaturity on my part. That is what will destroy my family. But see, so often we run from conflict as if that's the thing that's going to destroy our family. But if conflict is destroying my family, it's only because I am clinging to relational immature patterns. And I'm not repenting of those. I'm letting fear control me. If I'm working on relational maturity with my kids, then conflict is not going to be anything that's going to tear our family apart. It's not going to destroy it. In fact, in the aftermath of conflict, we're going to be closer to the Lord and closer to each other. Conflict is going to bring about spiritual growth, spiritual unity. It's going to be a hard experience during it, but afterwards, it's just like going out when you're first starting to run or whatever. While you're doing it, you hate it. But after a while, from enduring that kind of pain and the conflict in your own muscles and body, you start to get stronger and you start to feel healthier. And see, the same thing happens spiritually when we face conflict as a family. It's wrong to avoid conflict as a parent. I was talking to a dad recently and he was just saying, you know, I don't like conflict. I just always grew up just not liking it. And in our house, we just basically didn't fight about anything. Now, I can't believe, especially in a home where there's adolescents, there's not going to be disagreement, disappointed expectations, and if they're not allowed to come out, be expressed, they're all going to go underneath, and it'll come out in passive-aggressive behavior. It will come out in other kinds of ways that will be harmful. Conflict is the way to get out all the junk that's gunking up our relationships, all the junk that's gunking up our thoughts and our minds and our hearts. It's a way of getting the family to vent and air some of their disagreements and anger and resentment and disappointment with each other. Now, it must be done within some rules, fair fighting. You know, we don't throw things at each other or cuss and yell and hit. Those kind of things aren't allowed. But conflict is allowed. We do allow our family members to express disagreement, to express negative emotions, to express anger and hurt. We allow that to happen because that's not going to destroy us. Relational immaturity will. Now let's go to point 2 in your notes. Now, we want to talk a minute about what are the marks of healthy conflict management in parents. Now, let me just say that more simply. What are the marks of relational maturity that come out in the face of conflict? That was too long to put in the notes. What are the marks of relational maturity that are going to come out in the face of conflict? Do I have mature relationships with my kids? Am I in the middle of the scale? Or am I over here relationally dependent or relationally negligent? Or am I mature? What are the marks? And let me suggest that there's at least four. You'll probably find more. But let me say, first of all, there's an absence of distancing. An absence of distancing. Do you recall back about the third lecture we talked about distancing? And we talked about that these were some sample strategies that parents often use to distance themselves from their kids. And oftentimes, these are strategies that are used to avoid conflict. And again, it comes back to the whole thing of conflict will destroy my family. Therefore, I'm going to even become more relationally immature. Now, do you see how this becomes a vicious cycle? Conflict looks like it's going to destroy my family. Rather than work on the relationship, I assume that conflict is the problem. So then, instead of working on becoming more mature in the relationship, I move away and distance myself, which means what? Relational immaturity to a greater degree. Relational immaturity to a greater degree. So these are strategies of distancing. Distancing is a very immature way of handling relationships and conflict. And so one mark of maturity in relationships is that it's especially going to come out during conflict is, do I distance myself from my family? Do I withdraw? Do I pout? Do I use any of these kinds of strategies to distance myself? Say, it's okay. It'll blow over. Let's not even talk about it. Hey, let's go get ice cream and forget about it. Trivialize and go on through. Now, a second one there is another one we've mentioned before, and that's self-control that leads to reflection. Self-control that leads to reflection. We've talked about what happens before when there's automatic responses, and especially in the face of conflict, an automatic response is almost always going to create distance, or it's just not going to cause spiritual growth, spiritual dependence. Many, many times parents need to kind of hold off, hold back, and wait, and be reflective. I've been reading a book this last week, which I've really enjoyed, The Road Less Traveled. Picked it up traveling last week at the airport, and have been reading it. And I've thoroughly enjoyed it, would recommend it to parents a lot. But he mentions in here the whole idea here of being reflective parents. And I'm glad I can tell you that I didn't get the idea from Peck. But Peck talks about the fact that one of the biggest problems is parents do not have discipline. They're not disciplined individuals in this day and age. And one discipline that they need to develop is the discipline of reflection, he talks about. The fact that parents need to stop and reflect before they react, and they need to study. Self-control that leads to reflection. Now, those happen in the face of conflict. We don't distance ourselves. We stop and reflect. But let me talk about two other marks here, just very quickly. And the first mark is this. I want to just use one word, the word purity. The word purity. A relationally mature parent in the face of conflict, his responses are going to be marked by purity. Now, it's interesting that in 1 Timothy 5, 1 and 2, we won't turn there, but Paul is talking about how to deal with conflict in the family of God. And he says, listen, when you need to correct an older man, don't you dare do it harshly. But you do it as if he's your father. And when you're correcting a younger man, don't you dare do it harshly. You do it as if he was your brother. And when you're correcting a younger woman, don't you dare do it harshly. You do it as if she is your sister with absolute purity. Now, turn with me to a passage over here in 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 1. Verse 13. Therefore, he says, prepare your minds for action. Be self-controlled. Set your hope fully on the grace to be given when Jesus Christ is revealed. Those are all things we've just been talking about. Don't set your hope on your kids. Don't make them the source of your hopes. Don't make them the thing that's going to get you through it all. But you set your hope fully on your relationship with Jesus Christ. Be self-controlled. Gird your minds. Use your minds. Discipline your minds. Be self-controlled. Verse 14, and as obedient children, don't conform to the evil desires you had when you lived in ignorance. We all tend to be controlled by evil desires or wrong strategies. Don't allow those to continue controlling you. Now look at verse 22. Now that you've purified yourself by obeying the truth, so that you can have sincere love for your brothers, now love one another deeply from the heart. Now that you've done what? You've purified yourself. There's a purity that's required before you can really love deeply. That's what Peter's saying. And once you purify yourself, you're now eligible to love deeply. Now, what's he say is purity? Where he says, he goes back here and it says, not conforming to your evil desires that you had when you lived in ignorance. That's impurity. Purity is not being controlled by your evil desires as you approach people. Not being controlled by your evil desires as you approach people. Look at chapter 2, verse 1. Therefore, rid yourselves of all malice, deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and slander of every kind. Rid yourself of your distancing strategies. Rid yourself of your wrong strategies. And instead of using people to get your emotional tank filled, verse 2, like newborn babies, crave pure spiritual milk. That's where you get your tank filled, so that by it you may grow up in your salvation. See, we stay immature or babies when we use our relationships to fill our own emotional tanks. When we use relationships to fill our own emotional tanks, we stay immature. It's only by moving into a deep, dependent relationship with Christ and getting our tank filled with Him that we grow up. Maturity is only found by making ourselves dependent on Christ, no one else. Making yourself dependent on anybody else results in continued immaturity. Maturity happens when you become fully dependent on Christ. Now, none of us, short of glory, will ever be 100% dependent on Him, because we have sin that lives in our bodies, sin that controls our minds. But it's a goal. It's what I'm moving toward. And the more I'm moving toward purifying myself, and that's what I call purity. Purity is coming to the point where I'm trusting in Christ alone to fill my emotional tank. Impurity is when I'm using other people to fill my emotional tank. As I'm moving toward purity, then I'm going to be more and more free to love people deeply. I'm going to be more and more free to enter into relationships with my kids without being relationally dependent or negligent, but be relationally mature. Purity is required. And that's the ability to enter a relationship without any attaching any strings, to enter a relationship without needing to get anything, entering relationship without using distancing strategies, entering relationships without being immature. That's purity. And that's required. And that's a mark. And it's good. I'll tell you what. Nothing more than conflict brings to me my relational immaturities. My impurity sticks out in the face of conflict. And that's why I don't like conflict. I don't enjoy it. I don't go looking for it. But you know, when it comes, it can be a real ally. Because it exposes to me what I have to work on. It exposes to me how I'm still trusting in my relationships with people and not with Christ. And it's a good thing, then. Out of conflict, I can grow. I can say, Lord, I just can't believe it. Here I am. I'm just so angry because this person hasn't come through for me. I'm just so angry. I don't even feel like I can do anything. And Christ, here I am back again. I just can't believe how I just need other people to come through for me to make it through the day. I can't believe that, Lord. I just ask you to forgive me for that, and I just repent. And right now, even though I don't really feel like anyone cares for me or anyone really understands me, right now I commit myself to move back into relationships to serve these folks, to minister to them. Not to take revenge, not to twist their arm and get them to love me better, but I commit myself right now, Christ, in the midst of my loneliness, not to use people, but to serve them. That's relational maturity. That's purity. And as I move toward other people, not to use them, but to serve them, God can use that pure kind of pure heart. But see, conflict oftentimes reveals the fact that I'm not a very pure guy. I use people a lot. And I need to see that. I need that to be exposed in my life, because that gives me an opportunity to repent. That gives me an opportunity to confess sin. That gives me an opportunity to grow. And I want to grow. I want to be in deeper relationship with Christ. I want to be more dependent on Him. So purity is one of the marks. The other mark is humility. Humility. Now, humility is exercising my power as a parent without regarding my child to be volitionally or rationally inferior to me. It's exercising my power as a parent without regarding my child, or whoever it is that's under my authority, to be volitionally or rationally inferior to me. Now, they might have less knowledge. They might be inferior that way. And they might have be controlled by some pretty foolish ideas, and I'm aware of those. And so, in some ways, they might be inferior, but I want to be sure that I'm not treating them as being rationally inferior. That is that their mind cannot grasp the truth, that they really can't see things clearly, and neither do I want to treat them as volitional, meaning that they don't really have any control over their own choices. And we tend to do that as parents. We tend not to be humble. You know, remember in 1 Timothy 5, just now I quoted that verse, Paul says that when you correct younger brothers, younger men, that you do it as a brother. That takes humility. That takes humility for a dad to correct his son as a brother. It means to get down on their level, and you might need to exercise authority. There might be a disagreement, but you reason with them. You don't say, "Now you stupid moron, I can't believe you did that." Now that's exercising authority without any respect for his rationality. The fact that he's an image bearer in God, and he is very, very capable of thinking this thing through rationally and being different. But he hears me saying, you're rationally inferior. You can't think straight. You quit thinking and just do what I say. Or I treat him as volitionally inferior when I say, oh, no, you're not. You can't do that. Well, the truth is he can. And I need to respect that my son can choose to do what I ask him not to do. But if he does, I then also have the freedom to choose to apply consequences, don't I? See, my son can always choose his own behavior, but he can't choose his own consequences of his behavior. And I must always know, when I exercise authority, I must do it in a very careful way of respecting the fact that he does have the ability to choose to disobey me and not go the direction I'm asking him to go. He can choose to go another direction. I can also choose to make that direction as painful as possible for him, which I will, because I love him. And I don't want to, even if I lose relationship with him, it's more important for me that he experiences pain when he moves away from God than I experience pain when he moves away from me. See, it's more important for me. So when I tell my kid that he doesn't have the volitional capacity to choose for himself, you're going to be who I tell you to be, you're going to do what I want you to do, it's disrespect, and I'm no longer responding to him as a brother. But what I can say is, son, let's talk. Now I realize, son, that you're getting very close to being an adult. In many ways you are. And you know, I realize too, and now, son, you really can choose the kind of person you want to be. You can choose to be a kind of person that disregards God and disregards authority and disregards God's moral order. I sure hope you don't choose to go that direction, son, but you sure have that choice. You could go that way. If you go that direction, son, I'm going to do everything I can to show you that's not the right way. I'll talk to you. There'll be consequences. I'll discipline you. But if you choose to go that direction, you know, ultimately, son, there's nothing I can do to stop you. There's nothing I can do to stop you. I can make it hard, but I can't stop you if you choose to go that way. Now I'm talking to him as a brother. There's some respect there. There's some respect. So I must be careful that there's humility. Now, it's interesting that the Peck gets on the topic of that. And I just want to read a few lines here from Peck, The Road Less Traveled. He says this. He says, "The final impossibility, the greatest risk of love is the risk of exercising power with humility. The most common example of this is the act of loving confrontation. Whenever we confront someone, we are in essence saying to the person, you are wrong, I am right. And when a parent confronts a child, he's saying, you are being sneaky, and your sneakiness is wrong, and I have the right to criticize it because I'm not sneaky myself, and I'm right. He goes on. He says, for the truly loving person, the act of criticism or confrontation does not come easily. To such a person, it is evident that the act has great potential for arrogance. To confront one's beloved is to assume a position, at least temporarily, of moral superiority over the loved one, at least as so far as the issue is concerned. Yet genuine love recognizes and respects the unique individuality and the separate identity of the other person. The truly loving person, valuing the uniqueness and differences of his or her beloved, will be reluctant indeed to assume I am right and you are wrong. I know better than what is good for you, than you do. But the reality of life is such that at times one person does know better than the other who is good for the what is good for the other. In actuality, is in a position of superior knowledge or wisdom in regard to the matter at hand. Under these circumstances, the wiser of the two does in fact have an obligation out of loving concern for the spiritual growth of the other to confront the other with a problem. But he must do so with lots of reflection and careful self-speculation. See, humility says, I can't automatically assume I'm right and you're wrong. You have a mind, I have a mind, and you have the ability to look at things in a way I don't. And your perspective might be right. Let's take a look at it. That's humility. I'm regarding the other person as having a mind and having a decision to decide some things on their own. And in the long run, I might have to decide, son, I've wrestled with this. I've gone back and forth. In the worst kind of way, I'd like to say, yes, go to the party Friday night. In the worst kind of way, son, I'd like to do that. Because I want to see you having fun. I want to see you just enjoying your high school years. But, son, if I did that, I'd be violating my personal integrity. I'd be letting you do something which I believe in my heart is wrong for you. Therefore, son, despite the fact that you think it's okay, I'm going to say, no, you're not allowed to go. Now I've confronted him, I've talked about it, I'm doing it as a brother. And that's so different than saying, no, you're not. You're not going to those parties. I know what goes on there. Nope, don't even talk to me. Don't even talk to me about it. You see the difference? There's no humility there. It's arrogance. It's automatically assuming that my position is right and I won't even examine it with you. That's not humility. And that's almost always a mark of relational immaturity in the face of conflict. Now, let's talk about some of the skills needed. And again, when we get to these skills, I'm just so aware of the fact that I can just discourage the socks off of you. And that's why I just want to encourage you to consider that at the end of this 12-week course, when there are opportunities for you to get in small groups and other classes that work on these skills, that you take advantage of them. Now, I have a hunch why a lot of people don't get involved in small group stuff and work on that. Some of it's time, but my hunch is that a lot of people don't do it because they don't want to be exposed in front of others. They don't want to have their areas of immaturity and impurity exposed in front of others. And the problem is, it's very, very difficult for any one of us to work on this independently. We're great deceivers of ourselves. I remember we were doing an exercise in a small group last year, and we were doing a role play. We often do them in the small groups. And we were talking about listening underneath words and asking door-opening questions. And so this dad says, well, I think I've got this. Let me try it. So I played a son, and he came across, and he gave what he thought was door openers. And the questions were, where were you at Friday night? How come you came home late? And he rattled off 5 or 6 or 7 of those. And we stopped and said, now, wait a minute. Let's reverse it. You sit there, and now I'm going to be the dad, you be the son, and now let me ask you the same kind of questions, and you tell me how you feel. Okay? Here we go. And every time he started opening his mouth, I asked him another question. I said, no, just ask. And he said, is that the way I'm coming across? I cannot believe I'm coming across that way to my kid. But you see, it's so easy to just sit there and miss where you're relationally immature. We all are. It's so easy not to see these patterns. They're exposed better in small groups. They're exposed better where other people love you and where fellow strugglers are all saying, boy, we're all working at relational immaturities.
That's where these skills are best worked on. I almost feel guilty just going over them in a class like it's some kind of didactic material. It's really not. These are relational skills that can only be really worked on in the context of relationships. This isn't relational here. This is one way. I'm just talking at you. So I would encourage you to get involved in a group that can work and help you on relational maturity. That's our goal, relational maturity. But let's at least talk about the skills so we know what we're aiming at here. And you really find them all, I think, outlined very nicely or demonstrated in Nehemiah chapter 5. Why don't you turn there with me in Nehemiah chapter 5. Verse 23 of chapter 4 kind of gives us a feel for where Nehemiah is when this chapter is written. He says here, "Neither I, nor my brothers, nor my men, nor the guards with me took off our clothes. Each had his weapon, even when he went for water." Now that's just the last sentence before we come into chapter 5, verse 1. "Now the men and their wives raised a great outcry against their Jewish siblings," their Jewish brothers. Conflict in the family, brother against brother, brother against sister. And here's the parent working his hands to the bone, chapter 4. Nehemiah left a cup position as, or a cake position as cupbearer to the king of Persia. And he traveled back 1,000 miles or so to help his people who were in captivity and in disgrace rebuild the walls of Jerusalem so that they could have some honor again. And we see all kinds of relational maturity in Nehemiah. Nehemiah is one of the most relationally mature guys in Scripture. And there's so much of his interaction with people, you see a lot of good examples. Nehemiah 5 is often the chapter I go to when I'm looking for a model that I can follow in being a good dad or a husband. Because in the face of conflict, we see relational maturity here, which I really appreciate. And it's not during, everything's not set up here. It's not that Nehemiah is relaxing on his throne and he's twiddling his thumbs with nothing to do and he's sitting there kind of as a judge deciding between. I mean, he is out there involved. He's helping this wall get built. He's got enemies that are threatening to come and tear down the wall and destroy the people. He's not sure he's got enough food to feed everybody. He's not sure if he's got enough supplies to build the wall. He's trying to get everybody working. He's working himself. And he's entertaining people because all these dignitaries from the Persian king are coming through to observe the job, and so he's got to take time off and entertain them. So he's got all these things going on, and now there's conflict in the family. There's conflict. And they complain the fact that there's some abuse going on, and the people are actually loaning things to each other and charging high interest rates. Now, stop and think a second. Don't most family conflicts come out in arguments over possessions, one kid's possessions versus another's? And who really owns that? Well, that's the same thing here. He's got his siblings arguing over who owns what and whose possessions are whose. And in verse 6, we read this, "When I heard their outcry and these charges, I became very angry." Relational maturity does not mean that you can't become angry. Anger is not necessarily sin in itself. Can be a sign of some wrong things. But what I like here is verse 7. He says, "I pondered them in my mind, and then I accused the nobles and officials." I pondered them. Here we've got the example of reflection. He was a reflective parent. Now, let me mention a couple skills I see here right away. Skill number one, and by the way, the first stage is what we call the preparation stage. That's what we were talking about last week. That's the whole area of understanding, those five skills. But let me call stage two the ignition stage. Ignition. Conflict has been ignited now, and here's how I need to respond. The ignition stage. And the key here, the key essential characteristic of me needs to be taking initiative. When conflict ignites, my job as a parent is to take some initiative. Now, what kind of skills does that require of me? Well, number one is this: permitting others to be naked with their negative feelings. Permitting others to be naked with their negative feelings. Nehemiah allowed his people to be naked with their negative feelings. Now, that was not allowed in Persia. In fact, it was a law. The guy he used to work for, the law was this, that if you're naked with your negative feelings around the king, he can cut your head off. Nobody is ever allowed to be unhappy in the king's presence. And I think that some parents adopt that as their rule. No one is allowed to be unhappy in dad's presence unless dad is in a good mood. Then you're allowed to be a little naked with your negative feelings. Most of the time, dad is too wimpy to be negative around. Dad is not strong enough to handle our negative emotions. We can't be naked around dad. Dad is too weak. So when dad's around, let's tiptoe. Be very careful. Oh, don't talk to him about that yet now. He's not in a good mood. Now, there's some wisdom in postponing things until people are in a better mood. The problem is so many dads are almost never in a good mood. And so you can never be negative around them. The mark of a relationally mature dad or parent is that he permits the people around him to be naked with their negative feelings. And so they thought, well, we can cry out how we're feeling. We can act out how we're feeling. We can talk about how we're feeling, and Nehemiah's not going to roll our head, even though his boss would have done that. See, a lot of parents say, well, that's how my dad treated me, so that's how I'm going to treat you. I made it. And Nehemiah could have said, well, that's what the king in Persia did, and so I'm just going to treat you the same way my authority treats me. That's relational immaturity. That's automatic response. Relational maturity says, now wait a minute. It's important to me to know how the people under my charge feel. And so I will allow nakedness. I will allow people to be naked around me with their negative feelings. A second skill is this. Dedication to the truth over comfort. Dedication to the truth over comfort. And we see Nehemiah here being willing to listen to the truth rather than to stay comfortable. Almost always when someone comes to us with a complaint, it makes us uncomfortable. I remember for the many summers that I traveled with high school teams, I was like a dad to 26 teenagers. We had their complete care from the time they got up in the morning to the time they went to bed for 10 weeks, 26 of them. And I remember oftentimes I would have to solve the squabbles and to say yes or no to this or those kinds of things. And I remember oftentimes I just wanted to kind of get this machine, this team rolling. And kids would always be coming with complaints and that stuff. And my natural tendency would be to not want to listen to them. Because in a lot of ways I was dedicated to comfort, not to truth. I don't really want to know how bad things are. I just want to hear people say how good things are. And you know what? That's the problem also with getting on the circuit and being kind of a circuit-riding parent or a certain circuit-riding preacher. All you hear is your compliments. That's all you get. You don't stick around long enough to get the flack. You don't. And so if you're dedicated to truth instead of comfort, you're willing to sit down and consider the fact that maybe how you've been running the home is wrong. I just respect one dad so much that recently gave me a call. He just went through conflict with his son, and he called me to say, I think I did it wrong, Kevin. But can you get a minute? Can I think it through with you? And so we thought through. He says, yeah, you know, that, I knew. I went away, and there was a ring of the fact that I handled it wrongly. I can see now I was so immature. And he says, and so you know what he did? He went and sat his son down. He says, son, I just want to share with you that I really acted immature towards you during that time. There's a dedicated to truth over comfort. What do you think would have been more comfortable? A lot of dads, when they blow it in conflict, they just forget it, and then they'll come and they'll say, hey, son, let's go play football, or let me take you to the Cavs game, or let's go do this. And he tries to buy his son's forgiveness. Instead of coming back and saying, the truth is, son, I acted immature. Will you forgive me? That's too uncomfortable to admit that. That takes too much humility, you see. So we try to just forget it. And I hear so many kids saying, my parents, when they hurt me, they just act like nothing happened. My dad can blow up and scream and yell and even throw things. And the next minute when I come down, he just acts like nothing's wrong. He expects us all to forget it and just act like everything's right. Dedication to comfort instead of truth. Now, let's go on here. He pondered them in mind, and so then he made an accusation. And he says, you are exacting interest, high interest from your own countrymen. So I called together a large meeting to deal with him and said, as far as possible, we have bought back our Jewish brothers who were sold to the Gentiles. Now, look what we're doing. We bought them back from the Gentiles, but now we're selling them to each other. And they kept quiet because they could find nothing to say. So he continued, "What you're doing is not right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God to avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies?" Isn't there something here at stake that's more important than our economic prosperity? I and my brothers and my men are also lending the people money and grain. But let the exacting of interest stop. Let's give back to them immediately their fields and their vineyards and their olive groves and their houses and the interest we've been charging them, the hundredth part of money, grain, new wine, and oil. "We will give it back," they said, "and we will not demand anything more from them. We will do as you say." And so he summoned the priests, and they made a pact. They made an agreement that this is what was going to happen. A few other relational skills I see here. The third one, keeping relationship with God the supreme goal. Keeping it the supreme goal in the face of conflict. Keeping relationship with God the supreme goal. You know, Nehemiah could say, well, what does this really matter? You know, it's just going to cause more conflict, more problems. Here's all these leaders. And if I start raising a fuss and getting this thing going, see, an awful lot of times I've talked to dads who remain silent as they see their wives misusing their children. They don't say anything. I've heard so many kids say, "I just wish once dad would stand up to her." And I've been in a lot of counseling situations with those dads, and I say, How come you don't stop your wife when you see her doing that? "Well, I just feel like it's easier. You don't know what she'd be like. It's just explosions." And so there's this thing of spiritual growth for my family now is not my supreme goal. What is? Avoiding conflict and tranquility, harmony. And see, oftentimes we don't keep that spiritual growth. Sometimes my wife needs to be confronted because of her spiritual growth. Sometimes she needs to confront me. Would I rather not be confronted? Sure. But it needs to happen to keep spiritual growth as a supreme goal. Fourth, assuming personal responsibility under fire. Assuming personal responsibility under fire. Isn't it so easy that when people come to criticize or complain the way the family's being run, to not assume any personal responsibility for it? But I have found that there's almost no problems in my home that at some point I haven't been somewhat involved and have to assume some personal responsibility. As chaplain of the college that I was at before I came here, my job description was to care after the spiritual health of the school. So faculty members would come in and sit down and say, "You know, I think we got a real problem with the students. And I don't think we're really hitting the mark in chapel." I would have students come to me and say, "I think there's a problem with the faculty. I don't really think that they're participating in chapel like they should or helping us here." I have administrators that come to me and say, "You know, we got a problem with student-faculty relationships. What do you think? You know, I'm not sure if we're really hitting that in chapel." And it's so easy in all of that to start just deflecting criticism. It's so easy to start just being defensive and not listening to any of it. Instead of listening for, well, maybe there's something here, a personal responsibility I need to assume. Maybe there is something I could be doing different. Maybe there's something I could be doing to help the situation better. And as I listen and I'm willing to assume personal responsibility that is really mine, then that conflict and confrontation can end up for spiritual growth for all of us. You see, and so often parents need to assume personal responsibility. Kids come to you and they're not always wrong. Do you see? Maybe they're half wrong or there's some problems there, but oftentimes when they have a complaint or an outcry, there's some personal responsibility to be assumed in the whole thing too. But I often hear parents saying, "Well, sure, I've been harsh, but you know, if you act like that, what do you expect from me?" Now, how much a personal responsibility is he assuming for his actions there? The fact that I am a grouch and I don't talk to my family kindly is not my fault. It's my family's fault. See, there's no assuming of personal responsibility there. There's no sitting down and saying, "Boy, you know what? I bet I really have been a grouch lately. I wonder what's going on. Let's talk about this. Let's all sit down and talk this thing through. Now, I'm assuming some personal responsibility. I'm not exactly sure yet what I've done or what I'm doing wrong, but I'm open to the fact that I could be wrong." Assuming personal responsibility. One last skill we're going to look at today is exercising authority in the face of rejection. Exercising authority in the face of rejection. See, when it's all said and done, as a leader in the household, as the boss of the youth division, as the chaplain of the school, I have to make a decision. And sometimes it's just not the popular decision. But I have to exercise authority in the face of rejection, not letting the people's relationship and what my decision is going to do to the relationship control me. I should take that into consideration. But my main controlling factor is what decision will result in the spiritual growth of my family? What decision will enhance our spiritual health the most? What's best for my kid on that basis? And being willing then to make the decision, the hard decision, of doing that. Boy, I was just so excited a few weeks ago watching my favorite family theologian, Bill Cosby. And I was excited about the fact that they have a 13-year-old daughter, and they made a stand, no makeup until age 15. Did you see that episode? You know, that was just so rare to see parents exercising authority with the possibility of rejection. You see, that's just so rare. And I appreciate how they model that very often on the Cosby Show. It's a good skill. There's relational maturity in that mom and dad. If you stay tuned for Family Ties, the next one, the mom and dad are relationally immature and the kids are more mature. That's the difference between Cosby and Family Ties. In Cosby, we got parents who are relationally mature, kids that aren't. In Family Ties, the kids are more mature and the parents are immature. And that's where most TV shows come from. That's where they most come from. You know, I noticed there was a poll just recently on the sexiest men on television. And to my surprise, ranked number one as the sexiest man on television is Bill Cosby. And you know why? There's strength. There's relational maturity. And women are dying for it in men. Women are dying for relational maturity in men. A man who is strong enough to take a stand with his family. He won't retreat in the face of conflict. He won't distance himself. He'll stay involved with his family. Women are hungry for it. They're starving. And here's one guy that comes along on television, and he's relationally mature. You know who's ranked the last? Tom Cruise, the star of Top Gun, who's just a macho guy that is insensitive to everybody. He had the least sex appeal. It tells me something that women are still created in the image of God, and they still long for what God designed them to long for, and that is relational maturity. Here's a relational immature guy that's macho. Boy, that turns me off. Here's a relationally mature guy that's kind of, he's got a midlife pouch, and he's just, you know, he's not all that exciting, but yet there's something strong about him that attracts me, relational maturity. And that's what we're aiming for as parents, develop relational maturity. But underneath relational maturity is always spiritual maturity, purity. And that's where we're headed.